Welcome to the Depicting the Invisible podcast. I'm Susan J. Barron. I'm a contemporary artist, and my body of work, Depicting the Invisible, is a portrait series of veterans suffering from PTSD. This work is in direct response to the 22 veterans who commit suicide every day in this country. Depicting the Invisible is currently on exhibition at the Hunter Museum of American Art and the National Veterans Memorial and Museum. Each podcast, we focus on one portrait from the Depicting the Invisible series and do a deeper dive into the issues raised. I am thrilled today to welcome my dear friend Samir Bitar, leader in the museum field, to talk about this work as well as the role of museums in the public discourse. Welcome, Samir.
Hi there. Thank you.
It's so great to have you. Today, I'd like to share with you the portrait of Sergeant Akeem Brewster. Now, each portrait in this series is a mixed media work on canvas, 72 inches by 72 inches, a combination of photographic imagery, paint, collage, and text. And layered into each of these portraits is that veteran's story in their own words. The background is painted out of any time and place reference with a black on black abstracted camouflage background, alluding to a dark military experience. Brewster is a magnificent young black man with cropped dreads and ink, and he makes direct eye contact with the viewer. And this is his story. I was a homeless combat veteran. I'm deployed in Iraq. I'm the driver. A bomb went off, big explosion, so fast, so loud. Are we alive? We lost communications. We couldn't open the doors. The vehicle is so heavy, it operates on a hydraulic system. We were trapped. Most of the guys I deployed with committed suicide. I ended up homeless. 2 years is a long time to live on the street. Chadwick Parker was an Iraqi vet, dear friend of mine. One day he calls the cops and tells them he's shooting babies. Then he shot himself. I couldn't understand why all these vets were killing themselves until that's what I wanted to do. I can't explain how tempting suicide can seem. I had such depression, alone, tormented, internally black. I met Paul at VA PTSD program. We graduated. He went home. He dropped his girls off at their school, and then he shot himself. I keep his obit in my car. It motivates me to live my best life every day. Sergeant Akeem Brewster. So first, Samir, I'd like you to just share with me your personal response to this work.
Well, I know radio doesn't really provide for this, but, you know, that needs a moment just to sit with that. That's, do I understand it that Akeem killed himself?
No, he doesn't.
He didn't kill himself?
No.
Okay. I mean, this is real, you know. I've gone through the PTSD program, PTSD, military service. I guess we should also tell listeners, not only am I a museum leader in the field, I'm also a veteran myself. My brother, my next youngest brother, Billy, he also served in Iraq and also suffered upon return from PTSD. And in 2015, by gunfire, also committed suicide.
I'm so sorry. So sorry, Samir.
So Sergeant Akeem's message, you know, I do wish that this exhibition had been in Atlanta in 2014, 2015, and I could have taken my brother Billy into the exhibition because, hell, I wish I would have known.
Oh, like, stop at that thought. Wow. That's such a powerful thought. I wish that too.
I mean, so many of us don't know what, we don't have a name for what we're experiencing. And it wasn't until 2019 when I was diagnosed with PTSD. Like, I didn't understand why I would lose my temper. Why, I mean, some of my behavior that wasn't productive. I didn't realize what it was coming from. And I don't know that my brother knew where his choices or feelings or states of mind were coming from. Right. And to have to walk him into a safe space, like a seminar or a psychiatrist, like those feel charged. Those feel, I know people, I know a lot of people who stay away, shy away from those types of confrontations, if you will. And that's it, confrontation. And you know what it is? Museums aren't confrontational. You know, and walking him into a museum, you know, seeing some art, having a coffee, and then like breezing through, like not quite breezing, but like then happening upon your exhibition or the subject matter, you know, not talking about it. He does his own thing, but he leaves there in his head with a new vocabulary, a new experience, perhaps feeling a wee bit, a centimeter more, or inch more normalized.
Right.
I live in downtown Los Angeles now. And I chose downtown for a number of reasons, but one of the reasons is not to escape the reality of contemporary life, which is to say, in some ways, you know, the homeless problem. And I walk by scores and scores of homeless. And in fact, by the VA hospital in Los Angeles, out in Brentwood, there's an entire homeless, veteran homeless encampment.
Yeah.
Adjacent to a federal cemetery there, VA cemetery. And I see veterans downtown homeless, and I see veterans, and it's just shocking, confusing to me.
It's really heartbreaking.
When I read, hear Akeem Brewster's words, they're real to me, both personal, in my personal family life, but also I live it, I walk it, you know, in my Los Angeles life. This is, things are not to be escaped from. And I think this is the power of your work, not to jump ahead, but the power of your work, the power of art, in having us confront something in perhaps a safer space, a space that's more measured, that's not forced down our throats, that's not framed in entertainment. You know, there's not commercials or jingles or or talking heads giving their opinion. That's a lot.
Yeah.
You know, this topic is enough to deal with. It's just so much more for the senses to contend with all the other input. So art, especially in a sitting like the National Veterans Museum or at the Hunter Museum of American Art, this is one of the powers of the museum setting. The viewer, the visitor approaches, they choose when, they consume, you know, confront, face both the topic on view, the voices, messages being offered by the artists and curatorial teams, education teams, and they process it at their pace with really themselves, the environment of the setting, the art itself. It's just, it's a much more, dare I use the word pure, perhaps even ecclesiastic kind of an experience. And in a society, unfortunately, increasingly fraught with red and blue, you know, us and them, and just division. Museums, thankfully still, museums tend to be a neutral ground.
Yes.
Museums tend to be a place where we come together and, in this case, confront messages of soldiers, veterans, PTSD, and suicide.
Your position at the Smithsonian Institute revolved around the visitor experience. I'd really love you to talk more about that.
Yeah, so I was the director of the Office of Visitor Experience for the Smithsonian Institution. I was there about 11 years. Over those 11 years, I had the great fortune and the great blessing to be able to work with colleagues across many museums, and then finally at the institution level for all 22 in the zoo, affecting what amounts to, you know, a real close look, actual analytic sort of research on the visitor experience, defining what it has been, and collectively designing and solving for what a 21st century contemporary museum gallery experience could be or should be vis-a-vis the visitors. You know, earlier in the first museums in our country were actually late 1800s, early 1900s, there were private museums. There were private galleries, really, of wealthy individuals, wealthy Americans who would open up their parlors to the public. And that evolved into museums as we know them today. And that early stage of museums were typically always run by white, hetero, cisgender male, as you can imagine, in the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s. And, you know, these men had advanced degrees, if not, in fact, terminal degrees, you know, master's or PhDs. And so a very specific sensibility ruled, reigned the museum experience. You know, but you advance that 100 and some odd years later, 110, 100, around, you know, the early aughts, the change of the century, early aughts, you know, 2010, a lot, by then most museums in the country, even in England, had begun to reassess museums vis-a-vis the visitor, the actual consumer of, like the target of why the museum is there. And what we see are a more equalizing, egalitarian voice structure, so that along with curatorial PhDs and scientific PhDs, et cetera, artists themselves, you have a more diverse voice group, education staff, visitor experience staff, you know, architects, designers, you know, UI, UX, you know, user experience, user interface, a whole collection of contemporary thinkers across gender, across lifestyle. And by doing so, you begin to empathize with various types of visitors that enter and experience an exhibition. And so my job there was to kind of, you know, lead the collection of analytics, understand it, and then put forward solutions. And those solutions can come in the manifestation of redesigning physical spaces so that the furniture, the overall built environment is oriented to the visitor's needs and their experience, walking experience throughout a museum, instead of what could be phrased as organization specific. You know, over there is the volunteer desk, over there is the science desk, over there is the retail. And instead, like Microsoft or Google or the Mayo Clinic does, you design the services, you design the building, you design the product, if you will, around the user. And that's what a contemporary visitor experience for a museum now aims to be, and leading museums have are shifting towards that.
So it seems to me that museums can actually do more than just show a collection of work. They can actually be change agents in the communities in which they live. And I've seen this in both the Hunter Museum and the National Veterans Memorial Museum, where they do programming and outreach that really goes beyond the walls of the museum. And I wonder if you can speak to that. And especially in this past year that has been very difficult for museums, I think that there's been a big digital push where people couldn't physically come to museums, for museums to actually bring the museum experience into people's homes by creating digital output.
Absolutely. When pressed, humans, you know, what's the necessity is the mother of invention, right? Museums, you know, a lot of museums, to be honest with you, a lot of leading museums, even smaller museums across the country for the past 10 years, you know, have been growing their digital programs. I think most museums have begun, if not completed, digitizing their collection. Of course, a digitized collection allows for, you know, digital broadcasting of, and increasingly, as boards change out, boards and leadership of museums sort of modernize or reflect more of their community, you see a wholehearted, earnest attempt to bring the museum out of its four walls. You know, I mean, I was at a party this past weekend here in Los Angeles, and a cultural event producer, we're in a great conversation about society. He looks at me and he goes, "Why are museums so?" And he takes his finger and he like rubs, you know, he flicks his nose up in the air, you know, sort of that bougie, sort of, you know, stuck up kind of a sentiment. And it's a sentiment that pervades, unfortunately. It's a brand halo, if you will, a personality halo of museums that still exists. And digital is one way, you know, San Francisco MoMA puts in an actual vehicle and drives it around. Their museums have these solutions that include digital that literally take the work, the events, the programming out of the four walls and place events in communities. Two of the important things I think, you know, that art plays as agent of social change, you know, it oftentimes is one of the first to expose a topic issue. You know, looking back at the AIDS crisis of the early 80s, well, the 80s and early 90s, et cetera, you know, except for those who were hit hardest, which is to say, you know, Black communities, communities of color, and of course, gay men in, you know, hyper-urban settings, a lot of Americans didn't, you know, they heard it on the evening news, but it wasn't until it began to hit literature, formal art, exhibition, this charged topic sitting within that setting, you know, it exposes the topic for these visitors and gives them a much wider breadth of vocabulary, experiences. And to that point, it also personalizes. It takes from the abstract often, like you've done so beautifully. So often, I mean, if you polled Americans, I would say at least half know what PTSD is, or I've heard the term at least. They know what they, you know, I think 80 to 90% know what veterans are, but you're one of the first artists that I have seen, and I've been around this world a long time in the art world, in the veteran world, in some museum world. You're putting a face to these issues, to these concerns, to these tragedies. So again, your work exposes a topic to folks in Columbus and hopefully a broader, you know, public in America. You expose these topics of suicide, veterans crisis, PTSD, what it's like to be in war. Sure, we see Hollywood movies, and those help, certainly. They give it words, they give it names. But what you do, this portrait of Sergeant Akeem Brewster and his words is a different scale. It personalizes. And I think that's certainly not all, but definitely the power of art as an agent of social change.
Yes. Thank you for your kind words. Each portrait is quotes. So we know that this is the actual words of that actual veteran. And each one is signed off with his name and deployment. And I felt that that was such an important part of this project to show that this is a real person. There's a photojournalist named James Natchway. And in some level, I think that depicting the invisible is photojournalism.
Oh, absolutely.
And he says that bearing witness to these stories, the ability to empathize, identify with a stranger, it instills a refusal to accept what is not acceptable. And I think of your words walking through the homeless encampments in LA. And I feel that most people have a hard time identifying with those people and their stories. I think that there's just such stigma around homelessness, around issues of mental health, that we need to find a way to connect with these people. And in some way, that's what I was hoping to do, to try to break down those barriers of stigma and make a human connection, bear witness to these stories.
I think you've done that. And to your earlier question, I mean, what always came out of my mouth was, that's what really good art does. But who am I to say really good art? That's what art does. I think back on my years of understanding, analyzing, and teaching colleagues about visitors and how visitors encounter museums. And it's broadly accepted, broadly known. There are, you know, sort of three types of visitors, if you will. And certainly there are more, and they cross-pollinate, obviously. Humans are, you know, obviously as varied as the snowflakes that fall in the sky. That said, typically, you know, visitors, one group of visitors, you can call them sort of, you know, idea-centric type of visitors, and they will come through an exhibition. They'll read every label, read every didactic, read every piece of text, and they'll maybe reference the object on view, whether it be an artifact or a piece of art or, you know, an object. They'll refer to that to give life to the text, if you will. The second group, or another group, you can think of as the object-centered, you know, the beauty, the awe, the wonderment, the rarity of the objects on view. And they're the ones who make connections through the rarity of the object, artifact, piece of art on view, and just are able to become mesmerized, even lose track of time fall into the power of the work on Vue. And then they're the people-centric, you can call them, and they're the ones who really seek out group tours. They come with a buddy. They need to, they want to process what they're looking at with a buddy, with a friend, with someone in the family, a partner. They'll seek out the curator. They'll seek out an event. You know, oftentimes events are for these types of visitors because it helps to deconstruct, explore. And my point is, like, this is how we have to, this is how we, you know, some of the best museums are programming their museums, understanding that different humans are affected, are influenced, perhaps even are changed, if that's our ambition in society to, or in museums, to affect a more, I don't know, engaged citizenry. And you have to meet them where they are. And so you have to create programming and events and build your museum and your exhibition spaces to meet object-centered, to meet people-centered, to meet idea-centered.
To bring on a show like Depicting the Invisible, which is difficult in a lot of ways, I think that it's a very brave step for a museum to take on. If there's a show that has a lot of difficult issues surrounding it, do you change the visitor experience in relation to that?
Absolutely. Great intuition, or maybe you know this already. I mean, that's absolutely, we do now. We do now. And I'll give you a few examples. To your point of this specific exhibition, your specific work here, the message being difficult, it's a difficult exhibition. I'll just give the listeners a sort of sense of this, because on its face, it's like, wait, it's PTSD. Of course it needs to be talked about. But in some corridors, it's uncomfortable. And initially, the National Veterans Museum, it was a difficult conversation to mount because oftentimes museums want to celebrate. For instance, when the National Museum of American Indian opened in 1994 and then 2002 on the National Mall in Washington, D.C., you know, it's a museum built by and programmed, run by Native Americans. And it was an explicit, written down, orientation mandate that the museum celebrate the lives, yeah, the history, celebrate. And the first decade or more was about telling the hemisphere, certainly telling Americans, that we are still here. We are not a postcard relic. We are here. Native Americans are here, thriving communities. And I remember being at the National Museum of American Indian in New York City, running the visitor experience program there. And I had a very earnest, very, awoke Columbia undergrad student come into the museum and just read me for filth. Yeah, she called me out from the office. I came out and read me for filth for not having, how dare you not talk about the Trail of Tears? How dare you not talk about the tragedies that the white man has inflicted on? And I heard this, and that's valid. And I told her as much. And I said, the museum chooses not to. It's not run by white people. It's run by Native Americans. And their choice is. So, the National Veterans Museum wanted to celebrate opening a few years with a celebration of veterans. And this is a hard topic, PTSD. And so that's an example, I think, of what you mean by this is a difficult exhibition, because it raises topics that some institutions are just like, oh, not yet. I don't want to, you don't want to be that museum yet. And so that's, sort of that.
Yeah, I think that really with National Veterans Memorial Museum, they came to it through a point of view of, we want to tell the veterans' experience.
Yeah.
So we're not a museum of all these artifacts and these, battle plans, and that's a different museum. So what we want to do is tell the veterans' experience. And for a lot of veterans coming in and out of the museum, this is their authentic experience.
Yeah.
Maybe it was brave of them to take this project on, but I think that it was important.
Oh, yeah, and it's the right choice. And then to your point about how museums sort of accommodate or plan for even a space, a visitor experience that is difficult. I'll point to two very recent. So the National Museum of African American History and Culture, the newest Smithsonian Museum, opened in 2016 on the National Mall. Of course, the first national American museum that focuses on, celebrates, and details the both tragic and beautiful histories of African Americans. you know, it's a museum that's seven floors, and three of those floors are underground, if you will, like subgrade. It starts below ground at, you know, pre-America slave ships, and the harrowing story of how some humans, you know, did this horrific freaking thing to these other humans on these ships. And the space is literally built. It's a confined space. It's lower light, lower ceilings. It's constricted movement. On busy days, you're crowded with other people. It's a very brilliant architectural solution to activate visitors' senses beyond eyes and touch. You know, there's this other sense that's activated, right, such that as you spiral up those three subterranean floors, you're going through very tough. And anyone who looks in the mirror and acknowledges humans' dark side cannot come out of that, you know, with tears in their eyes. And the museum architects and museum leadership under Lonnie Bunch and a brilliant build team placed off to the side little sort of, dare I say, cabinets, little private spaces, understanding that you'll need a moment to yourself or your family. We'll need to cry. And a lot of us don't want to be that in public. Don't want to get messy or whatever, but maybe whatever. And the architecture can accommodate these very tough visitor experiences. Also staff. You know, I've done this at Smithsonian. I do it now. They did it to open the museum. You train staff, not just the where's and how's to answer questions and the ups and downs of the details of hardcore, in-depth, week-on-week empathy training. So you know how to hold the space for a morning or a, you know, a visitor having a very, you know, in their feelings, as kids say today. And know how to hold a space, you know, for all kinds of, you know, reactions to these very difficult topics. The National Veterans Museum also did this to a degree. You know, it has on the basement level or a booth. It's on its name. It's used to record visitors' experiences so that we begin an archive of all veterans, you know, American veterans, you know, from their own words on tape of their service, of any conflict they may have served in, PTSD, what their experience was in this exhibition, in this museum. So in a way, the National Veterans Museum also has designed into the architecture, again, a space that accommodates, that acknowledges this difficult content.
Yeah. I've actually had several veterans in the various places that this has been on exhibition tell me that they wait for a time when they can go when nobody is around. So they don't really want to experience it. Mm-hmm. They're not sure how they're going to respond, and they just want to have it to themselves when they go and see it. I've had a lot of veterans tell me that.
It's funny. I've heard from many gallery owners, many museum directors, you know, forever there's been this metric of like, what's your visit? In fact, nationally, you know, some of the, you know, art newspaper and all these big art-centric publications, you know, whether it be quarterly, monthly, they publish visitor counts. And that's been a metric that museum leaders and boards are held to, is what are the visitor counts? And so there's this almost frenzy to get, you know, what was last year? It's 1.2 million. This year has to be 1.5 million. You know, we have, what did that museum do? It's 4 million. We need to be 4.2 million. And more, you know, as visitor experience guy, my job, and marketing guy, my job has been like, get butts in seats, right? That's my job. But there's this wonderful wave of sentiment. Melissa Chu has this at the Hirshhorn. I've heard it from other private gallery owners that they want sometimes a more contemplative space is needed. I've heard leadership, you know, match that now and say, you know what, maybe the metric isn't millions and millions more each year. Maybe it's, you know, another metric could be, you know, how do we meet? How do we create, you know, these more, I don't want to say subdued, but I think the word contemplative is a good word. It comes to mind that allows the visitor to, you know, to absorb, you know, and I got to say, you know, modern society, all kinds of distractions. I'll tell you funny, but in my, you know, 2012, 2013, 14, I became the director of the central office, and, you know, new technologies and cell phones and apps were sort of new there. And of course, as trusted caretakers of the National Museums, you know, for Americans, we managers thought, you know, digital solutions for visitors, you know, digital screens, touch screens throughout the exhibitions, you know, phone apps, you know, the latest and greatest technology. Clearly, they, you know, these are available and they want them. And so we began to program these into the experience and spend lots of time and lots of money. And, you know, and then I would run these, you know, pan-institutional surveys, you know, entrance, you know, and exit and sentiment analysis. And visitors would tell us, you know, we don't want all this technology in our museums. You know, we get this at school, at home, on the go, everywhere.
It's that's so interesting. Yeah.
You know, like, and they literally told us, like verbally told us, we don't want technology to be in sort of intermediary or a sort of an interface between me and the content of the museum. And that was like a total aha, like head explosion moment for all of us managers.
I love that. I love that. I mean, I totally personally relate to that. I think that's,
you know, which of course isn't to say that we don't program technology. We do, but it definitely made me and made the managers that I work with at Smithsonian made us far more thoughtful and purposeful about where we place technology and certainly invite visitors in. Again, going back to a more contemporary visitor experience now, inviting visitors, you know, into the design process and getting their feedback on what's wanted, what isn't working, et cetera.
Right. So the Tate Modern talks about a kind of art utile or useful art. Yeah. They talk about that kind of work that is socially engaged and addresses structures in our society directly and becomes sort of a social and political currency to create conditions for society to shift, to actually inspire people to maybe step up and make a difference. And, you know, that's one of the things that I was really trying to inspire with Depicting the Invisible, to have people understand these stories and feel that kind of outrage and then saying, you know, I want to step up and make a difference. What is the role for museums for art utile, or that idea of supporting art that will inspire people to step up?
Well, I think we've touched on this. I think the very first is courage. Mm-hmm. Boards, certainly directors, leadership, curatorial teams who decide what the exhibition cycles, what the exhibition programs are, I think there's a certain amount of courage that is required. I've seen this, that is required because going back to an earlier point, museums are this neutral space, are this safe space for all Americans, regardless of your colors, whatever, to come in and experience, be exposed to messages, et cetera. And so museums oftentimes, you know, walk this very fine line, especially public museums, right? The private museums have a lot more bandwidth to do so. And so courage in the face of, you know, what certain public might say, or what certain societal sentiment may be, courage to program, and we're seeing that now. You know, last summer literally and figuratively ignited important conversations that have been long festering, you know, that, you know, we were not seeing the kinds of messages, the kinds of narratives, the kind of personal American stories on view that exist in America. And we're seeing some course correction in museum collection. And of course, if you're an object-based museum and you're pulling from your collection, well, you're going to have a very certain kind of voice if your collection's from a very certain kind of human or a certain kind of era. And so as we see museums democratize their collection and have their collection, you know, catch up to, hopefully, and begin to mirror society, and, of course, programming associated with that, leadership, in fact, I think all of those are really necessary and obvious, fabulous sort of elements, fodder for the courage required to mount, you know, what some might think to be provocative, or some might, you know, certainly think to be uncomfortable topics, but they're topics that need to. And this is the, you know, the socially engaged, you know, inspire. You know, I'm sure there are a lot of humans who still are inspired by Picasso. I mean, it sells out shows and, you know, and Van Gogh exhibitions. And nothing against these artists. These artists are amazing for all the reasons that you and I know. Right. Something very different to walk into. I work with a museum in or gallery in Chicago. It's a rather new gallery called Wrightwood 659 in Lincoln Park, Chicago. And in 2019, it mounted the largest survey of queer art ever mounted in the world. Of course, this was on the commemoration of the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall riots in New York City. This exhibition, sure, it showed some very famous, queer artists, but it also more gallery space was devoted to topics or subject matter that's rather uncomfortable. There's a lot of discussion about the trans body and images of the trans body, what it means to be trans, from M to F, F to M. There was a lot of harrowing imagery of artists interpreting loss or their own affliction with HIV, AIDS. So there's a lot of uncomfortable topics for a lot of people, for a lot of visitors. But again, courage from the gallery leadership, and having been there on the ground in Chicago for most of that run of that show, programming offsite events to post-exhibition experience offsite events. I was actually talked to by a mother who came to us, staff sitting there having over cocktails, and said to us, "Thank you. Thank you for programming this. My 13-year-old, now daughter is trans. I have no idea how to talk to them. Yeah. I support, but I'm afraid. I have all this mixed emotions about this child that I love," and seeing this content on view in that kind of space, it normalizes, it creates an accessible platform, and it gives you access to not only a topic and some vocabulary, but perhaps even some staff or some other humans with whom you can talk and process. So yes, to Art Utile, absolutely, to what the Tate Modern says.
Exactly. So, this reminds me of one of the Depicting the Invisible veterans who experienced military sexual assault, and she couldn't speak to anybody about it. She was so traumatized by it, and her husband didn't know, her parents didn't know, she didn't know how to explain it to them, couldn't bear to talk to anybody about it. And so after I did her portrait, she took her portrait to her family. She said, "I'm going to show you something, and we're not going to talk about it, but it's something I want you to know." And she just gave them the portrait. It was her voice. It helped her to be able to communicate something that was impossible for her to do. So art can play those kinds of roles. I can understand that family member saying, "This is really helpful to me." I think there's a sense that because people don't talk about PTSD and they don't recognize these different ways that they're feeling as something that other people have, there's a sense of isolation around it.
And we see this with a lot of trauma. We see this with all kinds of trauma, and modern society is allowing far more space for victims of trauma to actually name it. I love this movement. Mental health is a thing. You're okay to be feeling whatever you're feeling. We are allowing ourselves to name mental health. It doesn't mean you're broke. It doesn't mean you're lesser than, I guess, is the word. It just means it's just one more affliction that it can be solved. It can be healed. It can be treated, I guess, at the very least. And, PTSD, I think we're lucky veterans, if I use that word, are lucky to live in an America like we do today, where Americans, by and large, support and appreciate veterans, unlike veterans after Vietnam War. I mean, my Uncle Ron, Vietnam veteran, and he saw horrific, horrific things he couldn't talk about just because he couldn't. And society did not support him. The 70s and 80s to veterans in America is very different. Very different America than post 9/11. And I think younger visitors don't know that. I think unless you're 40 or older, maybe even 45, you won't know that. But that's true. A very different America exists now, where we do acknowledge and thank. I can't tell you how often, probably, every time someone learns I'm a veteran, they say, "Thank you for your service." Like my Uncle Ron, that wasn't a life he led. That's not the America that welcomed him back from Vietnam.
Exactly. I have a Vietnam veteran in this series, and he talks about coming back and being called a baby killer and being afraid to wear his uniform when he got off the plane because people threw eggs at him.
So, you know, we make progress. You know, we're not a society, American society, certainly isn't perfect yet. We have a lot to work on, but from definitely in this regard, you know, artists like you, truth tellers like you, artists are often called truth tellers, you know, heralds in some ways, you know, bring awareness, certainly raise consciousness to difficult topics, topics that do, in fact, when engaged and thought thoroughly through, tend to shift society. You know, they do. They shift people's sentiment first, and the sentiment shifts into economic behavior, shifts into political behavior. And these are the actual things that change our society.
Yeah, thank you for that. You know, I will say that Ken, one of the veterans in the portrait series says, you know, if we don't talk about PTSD, we can't save lives.
Yeah.
And ultimately, that's the mission of this work.
Yeah. That's well said. That's it. Period. He sums it up in a sentence. That's great. That's exactly the case.
Yes. Well, Samir, is there anything that we didn't touch on that you would like to talk about?
No. This has, I think, been exhaustive and hopefully helpful. Not exhausting. Exhaustive. Like, I think we've spent a lot in the conversation.
Yes.
That contextualizes your work in a museum setting and certainly talks to its role in this crisis, and hopefully its support of veterans and their families.
Thank you so much, Samir. You're brilliant, a gentleman and a scholar, and I really appreciate you being here today. My dear friend, thank you so much.
Thank you. I cannot thank you enough. And keep going. Keep going.
Okay.
I'll help you get it out to more museums.
If you are a veteran who is housing insecure, you are not alone. There are people who can help. Reach out to the organizations listed wherever you signed into this podcast. If you're a civilian and you're thinking no vet should be homeless, reach out to those links and make a donation or volunteer. Again, thank you for listening to the Depicting the Invisible podcast today. This is Susan J. Barron, and I look forward to seeing you next time.